Good evening. Oh, sorry. Dave, go ahead.
Sure thing. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Silmarillion Film Project. Believe it or not, everyone's here tonight.
Exactly. Yeah, I just went into autopilot mode there because, we've been missing you recently. So
I recovered from COVID.
Excellent.
Nick's children have recovered only to infect him.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. The two people with young children were both out sick last week, which doesn't seem terribly shocking, really. Yeah. Yeah.
New. And Corey and Marie, you guys are soldiering on. You guys all good?
We are. So far, so good.
This is an exciting night. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's coming. The other shoe is going to drop soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is an exciting night because we have it's season planning time, brought to you by Canva.
That's right. Look, Canva hasn't actually paid us enough to perhaps justify the plug, but
they could.
They could. That's right. We're open to it. I'm just saying. Should a Canva representative be watching, get in touch. But So we're gonna tonight is like when it sort of gets real, right? It's fun talking about things. It's fun kind of working out ideas and everything. This is every season, this is the episode where it feels like it moves from like random ideas that we've discussed into something like a production, right? So that's always a lot of fun. Looking forward to working through the shape of the season here today. Quick look ahead at the moots that are coming up. We've got one this weekend. I'm leaving tomorrow for Orlando for Sunshine Moot, February 17th. That's going to be a lot of fun. Then our next one is actually in April. April and May are going to be rather intense moot months. We've got Houston on April 6th. We have York, England on April 27th. Carlsbad, California on May 4th. And then Edmonton, Alberta on May 18th. So, that's going to be a really fun segment in through there for the rest of the spring, here, our busy spring season. So, and as always, all of our moots are hybrid, fully hybrid moots. So you can join us remotely if you can't make it in person. So, Dave, D-Rod Curry suggests that Carlsbad is the Anaheim of San Diego. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's
about right. Okay. All right. I don't know Anaheim well enough. I've been to Carlsbad, but I don't know Anaheim well enough to know if that parallel works. Cool. Cool. Yeah, also GD Tarian is also suspecting that the Canva rep might have some rather pointed questions if they discover that Canva would be in fact sponsoring the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad. So, you know, that maybe it might be a harder sponsorship sell than we think. but who knows? Who knows?
You could be paying for this wonderful plug that you're getting.
Oh, free. Man. Just think. All right. So I'm not even going to ask questions about the map. No, I'm not going to ask questions about the map, but it's always good to have it. And I may refer back to it. So big picture, right? Tonight we plan for the whole season. We're focused, you know, we're going to try not to get too deep in the weeds with the details of any of the particular stories. But of course, one of the things that we need to sort out is really like how practical is it to sort of fit all the things in the places where we want them to go. But really the first and biggest thing, I think, is the overall shape, right? How are we going to manage the balance of what we want to talk about? So, these are the things that we know, right? As Marie's laid them out for us here, we know we're beginning in Gondolin, right? So we have a couple choices there. We could do a pure Gondolin bottle episode at the very beginning, or we could intersperse that with some of our other storylines if we feel that we needed to do that. I that's a really good question. I think whether we return to Gondolin at all before Turgon marches out, or do we just like we leave Gondolin with Húrin and Húor at the end of episode one, presumably, and then we're all surprised when Turgon suddenly shows up on the battlefield. And then the midpoint turn is the arrival of the Easterlings west of the mountains. Do we want that to happen in episode 7 or 8? And can it be paired with the plague in the west? Well, that's really interesting. That would be fairly ominous. And of course, we're planning the war. How many episodes will we devote to the Nir-Naeth or Nordiad itself? Is it 2 or 4? One of the things that just kind of thinking through and looking over sketches for the season, we had a... So we've had, I would say, 2 real battles. Like, we've had battles and some of the other minor battles. But, you know, we paid some significant attention to, like, you know, the tactics and the story, battlefield storylines, right, of the glorious battle, right? And then, of course, even more with the Dagor Bragoach. My impulse is that the Nir-Naeth should be bigger than all of them. Like, this is the big, like, until the War of Wrath, this is the main thing. And I think bigger than anything that's come before, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. Of course it would have to be done in stages, obviously.
Yeah. And we already know, I mean, it already lends itself to that kind of large... I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, the Eastern and the Western fronts, right? You know, the different wings of the attack. Even in that sense, you've got, like, 2 totally separate battlefields going on. Now, we had different battlefields in the Dagor Bragalach, but that was purely defensive, right? It was just the armies of, you know, the sort of the flood of assault from Mordor was coming down and was striking the elves in multiple places at once. This is, well, as we know, not everyone among the elf kingdoms, but this is mostly the entire force, you know, all the force that the good guys can rally together, all making one big concerted fight. And like I said, nothing like that is going to happen until the War of Wrath. And nothing like that has really happened before, because even in the Dagor Bragalach, again, the only places where there were battles were places where people were being attacked, right? So this is a much kind of broader mobilization and everything. So anyway, I... Yeah, Meow indeed on Twitch says that she would argue that Nir-Naeth is greater than the War of Wrath in terms of narrative and impact. Agreed, but no, scale is what I'm thinking about. It's just as far as like trying to do it. And you know, it's a discussion for another day exactly how we handle the War of Wrath. But and we're not going to get into that right now. But again, certainly compared to anything we've done so far, I think it should be bigger. And we had what, 2 episodes for the Dagor Bragalach, right? And I'm not saying we need to count the scope of it purely in number of episodes, but I certainly don't think that we should hold back, especially since a lot of the more like preamble stuff, the, you know, the arrival of Turgon on the battlefield, even the stuff with Gwyndor, you know, the initial, you know, Bulldog coming out and murdering Gwilin and stuff like that. But we're going to want to make a big deal of a bunch of the departures, the departure, you know, of Húrin leaving, you know, Morwen and Tuor and Turin. We're going to want Rian and Húor. So having the battle kind of dominate the second half of the season in a way that's just different from the Dagor Bragalach, I think, makes a lot of sense to me. So I would certainly think that this would feel bigger, even if only because, again, this is coming from the good... The Dagor Bragalach was what it was because it came out of nowhere, right? So we had, like, normal episodes, wham, everyone's under attack, right, for 2 episodes. Whereas here, like, everything's going to be building up to that. So, like, the whole, we're starting, we're moving into place, we're making final arrangements and putting everything together. Like, in that sense, the work of the battle and the action of the battle is going to begin even, you know, long before the fighting starts. And so I think it's totally fine for it to be more. I don't have a number of episodes in mind, but I certainly think it should be pretty large.
Right. And with the planning, I just want to make sure we leave enough space for everything that we would like to put in there. So as you're mentioning, there's got to be a lot of preparation on screen.
Yeah.
Prior to the battle, and so we just need to make sure, however it falls out, that there's time for all the tearful farewells and all that.
Right, exactly. We have to start the tears early, right? Because, you know, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think that I think that makes a lot of sense. All right, so let's start with the shape. So, Marie, when you were kind of, in kind of putting this together, you've been thinking about it basically in sort of three movements, right? Three different acts?
Dylan was the one who had suggested that the first four episodes were looking like a solid act that had gone together. And so I went with that.
Okay, sure, sure. So under this concept, act one would include... So, all right, so the sketch here is... Episode one focuses on the story of Hurin Hur and Handir being taken to Gondolin, right? So we always knew that was where we were going to be starting. Because it really temporally does take place during season six. So it's not, not exactly a flashback so much as a temporary jump back in the timeline, right?
Right. We would have to orient the audience to what we're doing there because the assumption would be that we've just said, you know, at the end of the Baron and Luthien season, that's where we are.
Yeah.
So we'll have to show the tower still standing prior to their capture, probably, or not capture, well, the skirmish they're in where they get taken by eagles. So we'll want to see the tower still active and have whatever conversations are going on be about the situation prior to Baron and Luthien coming through. And then when we go to Gondolin, we have the tie-in of Baron and Luthien fly over on the eagles from season six, and when that happened we saw Gondolin from their point of view. We can see Baron and Luthien on the eagles from the Gondolindrum point of view in this season, so we can tie a few things together, but all that stuff has to happen in what's the past now.
Right. That by itself is a pretty good argument for essentially a bottle episode, right? Because it would be hard, I think, to dovetail it with anything else, unless we're wanting to do a similar kind of jump back with the other stories. But it seems to me like for the purposes of this season and the way that we want to focus on Hurin primarily and to a lesser extent Huor and Morwen and others, I don't want to be unfair and say we want to minimize like the time of, you know, Galdor and... and like that, the earlier generation. But I don't think we want to expand the time that we spend with them because we want to keep the focus on Hurin, I would think. And we'd have to. Like, if we were doing, meanwhile, while Hurin and Handir are in Gondolin, you know, that's where we'd have to go, I think. I mean, there are other stories we didn't cover while we were focused on Baron and Luthien that we could talk about, but... Yeah.
Right. Like, there's not necessarily harm in having a scene with Galdor and Dor Lomond where he assumes that his sons are dead, right? Mm-hmm. Just to have the cost of them being gone before they get back. Like, we could show that, and that would be telling part of Hurin's story. But we don't need a whole story with Galdor.
Yeah.
And as far as our other storylines, most of them can't really start until we get past the Baron and Luthien season. The only one that can start a little bit early is Sauron.
Yes.
Because he leaves the story partway through season six. He exits his tower and flees east. So we can show Sauron doing whatever he wants to do in the Barrow Downs anytime after the tower is down.
Yeah.
But for everybody else, we probably want to wait until we've had at least some time pass to get into the new story. So we know that it's new material with everyone.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And even with Sauron, his timeline, the early part of his timeline especially, doesn't matter that much. Like, it's not really important. So it's not like we must establish where he is in connection with the other stuff at that point. So, like, that is to say, technically, right, if we don't show Sauron at all until episode 2 or episode 3 even, technically we're jumping back in time, maybe, in showing him. But it wouldn't matter. Like, would it matter?
Maybe we're not. Just jumping ahead to where he is at this time. Yeah. So his storyline is very much just a bookend to the season. We're not planning to spend any significant amount of time with Sauron on screen.
Yeah.
So, since he's at the very end, I thought putting him at the, you know, in the first episode might be nice for that purpose. But since we're not going to spend any time with him this season, it's not important. If we don't show him until episode 3, like, no big deal.
Yep. Agreed. Okay. So, okay. So again, I think that the mostly bottle episode there, but I guess the big question there with episode 1 is, and I would think this is the only time we're going to be asking this particular question, do we have enough to satisfactorily fill a whole episode with what happens with them in Gondolin? Especially since, like, thematically speaking, what's mostly happening to them in Gondolin is nothing, which is what they're complaining about. I mean, we'll get to meet Gondolin, which is kind of a big deal, but...
Well, it helps that we have three characters who all have different perspectives.
Yeah.
Because we would need individual scenes with each of them experiencing Gondolin, right? Mm-hmm. And we have to get them to a point of wanting to leave, or talking about wanting to leave, or deciding that there's a reason to leave. So just being in Gondolin, being told, well, you're here and you stay here now forever, that's how Gondolin works. They have to more or less accept that up front, because what else are they going to do?
It's just the reality,
this is our life now.
Right.
So the growing dissatisfaction has to grow from somewhere. So there would have to be scenes leading up to that. Actually, no, we want to leave, and we think there's a really good reason why we should be allowed to.
Yeah.
And then we have to consider how quickly Turgon makes up his mind. Because it is true. I think that the issue is not that we'd run out of material, because you can just show off Gondolin material.
Yes.
All right, you got here, you can never leave. Well, actually, we've been thinking about it and we want to leave. Okay, goodbye.
Okay, fine. Like, yeah.
If
you really want to, then okay.
In half an hour of screen time, because we're not going to any other stories, if that all happens at once, it might be like, wait, what?
right.
So that to me is what needs more space to breathe, is the decision to let them out of Gondolin more so than anything else. But that doesn't mean we can't do it all in one episode. But that's definitely a reason to consider.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
allowing the story to spill over into the second episode.
Right. I mean, my concern was simply, I don't know, I mean, almost the other way around. Basically, like, I guess the question I'm asking myself is, how much are we going to be kicking ourselves and wishing we had some of that time for some of these other storylines? Right. You know, how much is it going to be cramming everything else that we have this, like, long leisurely, you know, let's chill in Gondolin for a whole episode. Right. And then later on, we're like, you know, cramming and crushing things in to squeeze everything in when it might have been nice to have half an episode to do some of those things earlier on. But it's hard for me with the time thing. It's hard for me to see how we could.
Well, what I would be willing to do would be to start the beginning of the episode back in time with their skirmish and how they get to Gondolin. And we see the time stamp things that let us know we're in the past. And then once the eagle passes overhead with Beren and Luthien and we've caught up to that part of the storyline, we're still before the wedding, before the end of the story, but we're getting close to the end of season 6 there. If we left Gondolin at that point and went and started telling another story, and then came back and finished the Gondolin story later, I would be okay with that. So if we really want another storyline to start in episode 1, we could bottle it for a point and then stop. Now, that's a weird structure, and I'm sure Nick is not liking my suggestion here at all.
I'm
but
just,
the point well, is...
Yeah.
There are things we could do if we're like we have to get something else started.
Well, I was thinking that Nick was being unusually quiet here. What are your thoughts about my concern that we might grudge the real estate for later on?
So, I feel like if we give an episode to Gondolin, it gives us a break from, like, a solid break from the last season's storytelling, which was very, oh my gosh, almost very Shakespearean, I guess. In a way, no, maybe not Shakespeare. Greek tragedy is probably more what I'm looking to describe here. And by doing a bottle episode in Gondolin, we kind of, because just like Hurin and Handir, there are going to be members of the audience who are going to be like, but I want to get back to
what's happening,
the rest of the story. I want to get back to the story that I've come to know all this time. And if we do a bottle episode in Gondolin, it allows us to kind of play with that feeling as well. And it's a good transition from the Greek tragedy of Beren and Luthien and into the kind of horrors of war story that we're about to tell.
I don't. I don't dislike the concept of a bottle episode at all. I'm just wondering about crowding.
I'd say there are other plot lines here. Yeah, I'd say we could do it with one episode. I don't think we can do it with more than one, for sure. And I am definitely not crazy about the idea of essentially doing what we did in season two, but in an episode essentially,
the division, the halfway division,
kind of like the Book of Boba Fett style.
That's
of storytelling.
That's just mean. But
I like the Book of Boba Fett, but I can recognize why people weren't able to get on board with it, though.
Yeah,
like you can see it.
Yeah. No. Agreed. Agreed. But yeah. Okay. So setting my worries, because it's nothing more than that at this point, aside, let's look at, I want to, before we get into like the details of what is here in Act One, I'm looking at the Canva. I want to look at the big shape of things. Okay. So this is the Canva that Marie has made. So we've got the Hurin line at the top, the Maedhros line, Galadriel, the villains, and other stuff here at the bottom. So let me expand this a little bit so we can see most of the things at once here. Okay. All right. So the big shape. We've got Hurin and Gondolin in episode one. Episode two. All right, hang on. I don't just want to go through episode by episode. I want to look at what happens, like, I want to get like the major kind of beats of the season and think about like what has to happen in this whole part of the season, and how that's broken down. So we're episode seven is what is currently sort of suggested. That's the turning point. The Easterlings come in. Things are starting to get serious in the planning of the battle here. The plague.
Quite honestly, episodes 8 and 9 are actually rather on the empty side.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Yes, I agree. which is why they actually have gray suggestions of we should go back to some other storyline we're not telling.
Right.
Yeah.
you can choose which one to include.
Right. G.D. Towering was just suggesting the plague. Let's talk about that for a second. Where do we see... We've mentioned the plague as, like, just the fact that it's going to happen in this time, and that that's going to be a factor. But we haven't really talked about it in the context of... Like, we talked about it in the context of, like, what it's going to mean to people, like, the death of Lilith and everything. It's gonna have an emotional impact on people. But this is going to be perceived to be like an act of war by Morgoth, right? I mean, that Morgoth is sending the plague, or at least that's going to be suspected. And so how is this going to feed into the movement towards the battle has begun long since, right? Is this going to be, are we going to be using the plague as some kind of tipping point? Are we going to be using it, especially in the way in which we're thinking of potentially, juxtaposing it, if not actually coinciding it with the arrival of the Easterlings, which could be used as like an ominous portent, or like I'm not sure how in the bigger picture of the season we're utilizing the plague. If you see what I mean,
because it feels arbitrary, like it just feels like a random, like why is Morgoth even like what larger scheme is this part of?
Yes,
if any. And because what if it's not actually Morgoth? Like, we could go that route where there's people who think it's Morgoth and are blaming Morgoth for it, but in fact, it's people get sick. Like,
well, and part of why I asked if it was going to coincide with the arrival of a giant army of humans from the other side of the mountains is that, like, migration and the spread of disease are not unrelated. So
right.
If we ever have the Easterlings arrive at the end of episode 7 and then episode 8 is when the plague happens, it would not take much for someone to go, wait a minute.
Right.
And of course, we also have to remember that elves don't understand things like epidemiology.
Right, because that's not a thing that affects them. Exactly. So it was strictly a human issue. Yeah.
So it's not something they would have anticipated or even really understood, possibly until well after the fact.
You know, it's. I mean, just think about the Columbian Exchange. Like, I've said this before. Like, let's say that everything was handled by the Europeans perfectly, which it wouldn't have been, but like let's say that it had been 90% of the population of the Americas still die due to disease.
Right,
like that's horrifying.
So diseases evolve with humanity, right? And therefore, populations that have been in the same place for millions of years, the diseases have progressed for over millions of years. Populations that have moved into new areas didn't have the exposure to the diseases and therefore not the immune system to counter them either. And that's what happens is that's the Americas is pretty much the end of humans spreading out around the world.
Right.
And therefore, a very new population compared to an older established population. You just have completely different disease situation. We won't be having that with
the Easterlings. Only a few hundred years ago.
Right. That's not the situation at all. So from that point of view, like, I don't want to try to recreate that. That would be more of Numenoreans coming back into Middle-earth after having been out of an area for a long time. Like, you need thousands of years, if not tens of thousands of years, to have established that level of separation. Well,
the big thing with the Columbian Exchange disease transmissions had a lot to do with the fact that people in the old world lived a lot more closely with domesticated animals, by and large, than did right. people in the Americas. That's not to say that people in the Americas didn't have domesticated animals. They did, but it was nowhere near the scale.
Yep.
And yep. so...
No, I think... Well, I mean...
I mean, they like, there but, could but this, be this things brings engineered us, to do that.
Yeah. But this brings us back to the bigger question, right? Which is, to what extent do we want to, you know...
I mean, it doesn't have to be a natural thing. It that's could my just question. Be Morgoth.
To what extent do we want it to be a natural thing? And it could be... It doesn't... This is not just a binary question, right? It doesn't have to be either just, you know, a biological attack orchestrated by Morgoth or a natural incident that has nothing to do with him. There's gray area in the middle, you know, that could easily fit there.
For questions like that, it's often nice to not answer them for the audience and let it be their choice how to perceive it. Doesn't mean we can't make a choice of what we're trying to portray.
Right.
But I would be fine with ambiguity in whether the plague was actually caused by Morgoth or not.
And like the people in the show could be convinced that it's Morgoth, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it is. So if it appears random to people, they might come to the conclusion, well, maybe it is random. You know, maybe our you know, Iron Age people in this show, not Iron Age, but, you know, medieval-ish people in this show are wrong about science.
Well, but I think so. But the more important question is, assuming that some of them do think it's from Morgoth, how does that affect them? Like, how does this change the story?
Right.
Like, this is what we need to sort out, right? What is their what is the response to it? What is the response to the plague? And we need to think about this. Like, what is the response in Dor Lomon, right? What is the response from Mythros, right? What is the, you know, he's, yeah, okay. So, like, let's just ask that question, right, in a couple different ways there. Dor Lomon is where it's going to hit hardest, right? That we're going to show, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does it hit Brethel? Do we know that? I'm not sure. We know it hits Dor Lomon, right? That's the primary element, primary story element that we have. So we're gonna have it sweeping across Dor Lomon. What do the people of Dor Lomon think about that? It seems hard to imagine they're not going to blame Morgoth for this. So what are the consequences of that for them? Is this something that is going to significantly increase the impetus towards war?
There's going to be kind of a bifurcated response in that you're going to have people who are enraged by this encroachment, but you're also going to have people who are realizing, oh, this is a seriously powerful enemy that can do really bad things to us, and
we have declared war on the god of plagues. Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something
seems like
we should
terrible
think twice
idea.
About. Yes. Yes.
So it could almost become a crisis of leadership for Hurin, because he's very distracted at the moment, because it affects his own family.
Yes.
And so he's not really in a great position to, like, rally the troops and give stirring speeches about how he has a clear plan of how to move forward, right?
Right.
He's grieving and probably in a bit of shock. Like, I don't know how quickly we're going to make an illness progress, but the amount of time from, oh, people are getting sick, to, oh, my daughter is sick, to my 3-year-old daughter is dead, like, that probably is a very quick progression.
Yes.
And, like, you don't usually, like, be like, of course. So, as planned, we're going to now do this. Like, that is not the next step.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, Hurin's... We have to first work out what happens within Hurin's family. Right? How does this affect Hurin? How does this affect Morwen? Right? we know more than anything about how it affects Turin from the Narn, right? He's the one whose account we get of this, in a sense. But because we get that story from Turin's point of view, essentially, we don't really know how it affects Morwen and how it affects Hurin. So we need to sort of figure that out as part of the story. The one thing which is just the sort of the obvious cue that I would hate to miss is the sort of quasi-allegorical touch of Lilith's name, right? That the great plague brings about the death of laughter is, to me, a fairly plain prompt, right, about how to take that. And what does that mean? What does that mean for Hurin and his own resolve and his own situation? And therefore, because first, yes, he and Morwen have to cope with their family crisis, but then that their coping with that family crisis then also becomes like he then has to help his whole people through that crisis. I mean, there can be a little bit of synecdoche involved there, right? It is a genuine crisis of leadership, but again, assume like however Hurin and Morwen themselves emerge out the other side can be a kind of picture of what's happening in Dor Lomond as a whole. And we can see him kind of extending that outward, you know, in some ways. But this leads me again to think about when we want the timing of this. Because if we looking for a second at the... I want to look at the Maedhros plot line. That is like the actual build-up towards the planning for the battle and everything, right? So if we're... If it's episode 4, when he first comes to Fingon, right? Mm-hmm. So we have Maedhros meeting with Fingon and convincing Fingon to join the Union, which means that Hurin is going to be on board relatively soon, like at that point or soon afterwards, right? So by episode 4 or 5, at the same time he's marrying Morwen, Hurin is basically on board with the war, right? With the battle, with the attack. Mm-hmm. So, and then we've got, the summit happening in episode 6. So if the plague is following all of those things, right, then we have all of the major decisions about pretty much all of the major decisions, about whether we're going to join the battle, like who's going to fight in the battle will have been made by the time the plague comes around. So it's not going to influence that. What it would influence is not like, should we do this or not, but like, should we follow through, right? If it's going to prompt something, I would think it would be prompting like doubts and uncertainties as to whether or not this decision that we've made some time ago now is really a good idea.
So... I was going to say that as far as Hurin is concerned, like the way that the story is described suggests to me that he would be despondent after the loss of his daughter. And that causes this crisis of leadership, as you described, this crisis of confidence amongst the people of Dor Lomond. And we had discussed maybe Morwen is like she is steeled by this. Mm. You know, she like Morgoth took her daughter, and she, you know, now she, you know, while before she might have seen Hurin's desire to go into war against Morgoth as kind of a boyish fantasy, now she's more like, you need to go get him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because that is the other reaction, right? When we talked about the reaction that says maybe we should think twice about attacking the god of plagues. But the other thing is, hey, with our elvish allies, we've got a chance to take down the god of plagues and prevent this kind of thing from happening again. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not just a mad suicidal attack on their part.
Right. Right.
At least they don't realize it is. they don't think it is.
Neither does the Chronicle of the Chronicler of the Silmarillion, though. So you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I do think that the reality of what the battle is going to mean hits right about in the aftermath of the plague, because up until then it's been planning and talking about it. And right after this is we're going to start actually mobilizing.
Right.
And so that shift from talking about doing it and planning to mobilizing, I think that will match with where the plague needs to fit.
Yeah. Yeah. This does incline me to shift the plague into episode 8. And I could even imagine putting it into episode 9 if we wanted to. Depending on how other things lined up. Because, again, the role that we're suggesting this is going to be playing is this, like, final test of resolve, right? This, figuratively, on the eve of the battle, test of resolve, right? Are they going to follow through? So not to have it, not to push it up into the turning point, but past the turning point, right, when everything is in place. And so that way we're not trying to do the Easter... So I think I definitely want to separate the plague and the Easterlings. And it makes sense to me in the overall shape of the season to have... Because the arrival of the Easterlings is the big, huge, unexpected, catastrophic infusion of hope, right? And to have that happen and then the plague happen, which, like, now you've got to, like, persevere through that. And again, the elves are not going to be affected by it. Like, they'll see it, you know, affecting their allies, and that's going to be sad. But it's, you know, and it's not like it strikes a major blow against the preparations for the battle, big picture, right? Okay.
So then if we want to move the plague later in the storyline, which I think is reasonable, one thing we can move earlier is the relationship between Huor and Rian.
Mm.
Like, they need to get married before he leaves for battle.
Yep.
So that's pretty much our requirement on that. And she's quite young, so we didn't want it to be a beginning of the season story.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to happen right before the battle. So if we want that to go with some of the more hopeful stuff earlier, we could pair that romance with the arrival of the Easterlings rather than the plague. You want something happier and more uplifting.
Right, exactly.
We were going to play that one more as a traditional fall in love romance kind of story.
If we're shifting the death of Lilith until later, there's nothing other than the birth of Turin on Hurin's plot line between burying Morwen and then eventually the plague, right? So, we absolutely could move that earlier. It might be fun to pair it, to sink it to the summit.
What are we gonna put with the summit?
The wedding.
The plague?
The wedding.
Oh, okay. All the way back.
Yeah.
Summit.
Episode 6. It's like, on the one hand, like, we do only just have to get them married, but we don't have to wait forever. I mean, at that point, will have been 2 seasons, and Hurin will have a kid, so...
Yes, but, I mean, she was 13 at Luthien's wedding.
Okay. But how long has it been?
Couple of years, if you're... I mean...
Right?
He's old enough. Yeah, that's what... When I said we needed a little bit of time, we do need a little bit. Yeah. But I can look up the year that Turin is born and see if there's any harm in making it the same year as that. I don't recall the exact year off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I think we don't
want to have Huor marrying an 8th grader. So, like, it's okay for us to wait a little bit more if we have to. It's if we have a little bit of flexibility, it might be a fun thing to move a little bit earlier on. to make it part of the sort of upswing. On the other hand, I mean, I would almost basically, I think I would argue for one or the other, essentially, that we would either move it significantly earlier, like episode 6-ish, or mm-hmm. have their wedding be like on the eve of the departure.
Okay.
Essentially. You know, have them have their, you know, marriage, wedding night, he marches off the next morning.
Okay. That's late.
It's all we need.
Yeah, I know. I understand what we need out of this relationship.
Yes. Okay. I'm just again thinking about that itself. I like the way that a very last minute thing like that kind of highlights the, you know, the hope and despair question, the you know, the tragedy of the thing, right? Also the sort of the stubborn, it's like a very mortal thing to do. Like, so exactly what an elf would not do ever, right?
Right.
And so I think that it's just sort of another, I mean, there would be comments about that, right? I mean, could you imagine the elves' reaction to that?
Yeah. There's a slight logistical question about that, though. The birth of Tuor would then happen months after they went off to war. Now, this whole war could take months, Tuor is bringing up this exact question. I don't think Rihanna's gonna last 9 months pregnant with Hoor after the battle. Yeah, that was what I was kind of going with there,
right? But the battle doesn't, it's not a day.
No.
Right, so Rihanna is 22 when the battle happens. So just, I mean...
So we do have some time.
We do have some time. If we keep Lilith's birth in 466, then that would be 6 years before the battle. So okay. The plague would happen 3 years before the battle. So...
Yeah, so we do have quite a bit of time passing episode by episode in the middle of this season.
Right. I mean, well, there's like 10 years over the whole course of the season. So we have time to do anything we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was just a little nervous to move that wedding up to the very beginning of the season.
I wanted it a little later. Not the very beginning. Not the very beginning. Yeah. 6 is the earliest I would suggest. But so what about how long before the battle is Turin born? Turin is, he's going to be what? He's going to be like...
Okay, so Turin's born in 464, and the battle is in 472. Now, Turin being born in 464 means we would need to get her and back to Dor Lomond by then.
Yes.
Which is about when the Baron and Luthien season was ending, and it's about when the people moved from Brethel to Dor Lomond, which is where Morwen is.
That's a bit of a hustle.
It is. So we probably kind of just wanted to smudge over all the years in the beginning and be like, and then he comes back and he marries Morwen and Turin is born, and let's not worry about how many days and months that all took.
I think that seems wise to me. Especially since, honestly, like, if Turin is supposed to be 8-ish at the time of the battle, 8, 6, 10, you know... That seems kind of fungible to me, as far as like the role of his character, right, and the place that his character is in.
I mean, he has to still be a child when he goes to Doriath, so we can't make him significantly older.
No, exactly. But as long as he's
so much younger that he doesn't remember his sister.
Exactly.
So that's pretty much our
or his dad.
There.
Yes.
He has to be old enough to have childhood memories.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, that could be. As young as 6. If he's 6 at the time of the battle and his sister dies like a year before, he's 5 when his sister dies. That could still work. I mean,
yeah,
it's pushing the envelope, but yeah.
Right, yeah. So I'm not super concerned with teaching the audience what year it is
right. yeah.
throughout this season.
Yeah.
As long as we
Do want to make sure it does make a certain amount of sense. But we do seem to have some leeway there, so I'm not too worried about that. Okay. What you see when I was thinking about who are in Rion and the summit, right? What I'm thinking about is like where does it make sense? Like, what do we want to line it up with? When do we want that particular? Because it's kind of a big deal. Huor is one of our like secondary main characters, right? I mean, he's in our like second tier of focus characters in this season. You know, in that he's like one of the primary accompaniments to our focus character here. So him getting married, kind of a big deal, especially given. You know, his prophecy at the end and the role of the son later on. So we don't want to just kind of squeeze that in somewhere arbitrary in the middle of the season. So it feels like that's why I wanted to make that. I was thinking of the coinciding with the summit as that seems like a, like, let's get together and make cheerful agreements for the future kind of moment that we could have that kind of resonating in Dor Loman as well as at the summit.
Okay.
Or we do it at the last minute. So that's why my secondary argument is at the last minute, as because then it works as a theme of like stubborn hope in the face of, you know, oncoming probable death, and we're going to do this, and all the elves are going to be totally puzzled, and we're going to explain this is how humans think, not how elves think, and this is why, you know, there would be some utility in either one, but like having it just be a random place, like the Easterlings show up and P.S. Huor got married, like that feels random.
Well, the idea there is that if we have a story in East Beleriand, we would need something happening in West Beleriand. So that's the Dor Loman story for that episode. It wouldn't necessarily connect to the Easterlings, except that we have building hope with the Easterlings, and a wedding is a happy thing to put with building hope. The other romance we have in the season is Gwyndor and Finduilas.
Mm.
And we probably need that to get introduced at the summit meeting, in the sense that Gwyndor's going to be there, and we don't get a lot of time with him on screen, so we have to at least understand that he and Finduilas are a thing in that episode.
Right. Yeah. When do we have... I forgot about good old Gwyndor. When do we have Gwyndor's decision to go and, you know, Finduilas... Like the, you know, the frosty quasi-conclusion of their relationship that we discussed before. Well, where do we see that winding up?
That would be with the leave-takings, I would think, where we have a much more tearful leave takings in Dor Loman. What's going on in Nargothrond is he's being told, you know, if you leave, don't come back, essentially.
Right.
So I assume that goes with the leave takings.
And
unless
those
we had a reason to do it earlier.
Right. So we're talking episode 11?
Well, yeah, later, definitely.
Later. Yeah.
So maybe 11.
Okay. Or 10.
Well.
Or 10. Yeah.
Because I have.
He has to be part of the logistics stuff. So.
Yeah.
I have a draconic idea.
Okay.
That I think because one. We need to indicate the size of this battle, and the best way to do that is by demonstrating that it's a campaign rather than just a thing that's happening.
Yes.
And I was thinking, while I like the dragon trap idea, I was actually thinking, why not just make dealing with the dragon the first stage of the battle itself, and just move the whole thing with the dwarves into that.
Oh, take it out of the battle proper.
Right. Well, I mean, it's still part of
it's
the part, war.
Yeah, exactly. It's phase one.
Right, but this is the first engagement of that war, and what that would do is that would create the situation where now the dwarves have left, which is a big deal because they were running all of our siege equipment, and maybe that's still there. but it's not going to be as effective without them. You know, like the, you know, sure, the elves and the humans could figure out how to use it and go ahead and still use it, but it's not going to be as effective. And then that's countered by the sudden arrival of the Gondolinodrim. So you get that kind of
right
Pelennor Field style flow.
We definitely are going to have ups and downs in this whole battle sequence, which we do need to pace out when we discuss it in detail. But as far as what, you know, what fits exactly when, I agree that starting the battle early, in the sense of all the logistic stuff of moving the troops into place and having attacks before the battle, does lend itself to that. There is the issue of if you make the Glaurung situation entirely the first story of the battle, then Gwyndor's charge doesn't feel like he started the war.
He doesn't, though.
It's right. It's not exactly the start of the war. It's the start of the festivities on that particular day, contrary to the plan, right?
But the contrary to the plan part. He's definitely going off book.
Yeah.
So I just, as long as we can preserve that element of his storyline.
Yeah, I think it would, because, like, essentially, so Nick, here's what your suggestion feels to me like what it would mean for the flow, right? Be like, okay, battle phase one, we have to do something about the dragon.
Not just the dragon, Dorthonian, which is the way it's described.
Yeah. So Dorthonian and the dragon, right? That's the which is, by the way, this makes all kinds of tactical sense. Let's not go into war in the north with Dorthonian behind us, right? Like, that would be stupid. So let's handle Dorthonian first, which means handling the dragon. And so, and the result, success. Phase one is successful. Right now, like, the dwarves leaving afterwards,
that's bad.
It's bad. But honestly, that can be kind of spun in two different ways, right? You're Mythros. You say, okay, we've lost the dwarves, but you know what? Look at what the dwarves accomplished, right? Like, it was still a win. Like, the dwarves, like, the connection with the dwarves still bore fruit, right? Even though, it'd be nice to still have them, but, you know, net gain, right?
Yeah.
We lost the dwarves. We took out Glaurung. Net gain for our side. Phase one is a success.
Right.
So now we can move on cheerfully to phase two, and this will be great. And Marie, that's where Gwyndor. So it's then phase. So everything is looking. Everything isn't perfect because we have the downside of the. And anyone who's grumpy about it can be like, see, everything is going wrong already. We've already lost the dwarves, and. The people who are holding on to Umdir can easily say, come on now, you know, look, it was just still a net gain, right? Then things in phase two start to go poorly. But I know we're going to be planning out the phases of the battle with a little bit more difficulty. But I kind of like that idea. It's a little tidier because we had been theorizing some kind of a failed attempt, ultimately, to entrap Glaurung, which would then result in him coming out onto the battlefield. But it would still create the difficulty of our having to manage him on the battlefield until he encounters the dwarves. But so I kind of like that. And I can imagine the dwarves being in, because of their experience with Glaurung before, the dwarves being willing to kind of be involved in the dragon assault in Dorthonian.
Yeah. Until it goes terribly for them.
Until it goes terribly for them. Right. Or again, it goes gloriously well for them.
And you know, we did what we were supposed to do. We did our bit. We're done. This was our part of the deal.
Right.
And it's actually not impossible. So you guys had talked about having this separate army and Corps of Engineers it's possible the Corps of Engineers doesn't leave.
Right.
Because they weren't there. Like, they don't walk off the battle carrying Azaghal's body. So maybe they don't go.
Right.
In which case, it's still, that's very much a net win.
Right. Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, though, I was immediately thinking when you were with your suggestion before that the dwarves leave, but they leave the siege engines there, and then, you know, Ulfast people are like, or Old Orcs people are like, hey, we volunteer to, we'll take care of this, you know, it's, we'll take over.
Right? And then they don't.
Right. And then they don't. Yeah. But anyway, this, I think, especially with the Glaurung, if we consider Glaurung phase one of the battle, which does make all kinds of sense, that would still give, that would basically give us a four episode arc for the battle as a whole, you know, for the campaign as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
With, and that would mean I would push leave takings into episode nine.
Okay.
Potentially.
It could still be 10 if
possibly
no one, if nobody who's doing the leave taking is involved in the Dragon Dorthonian plotline.
Yeah, they overlap. That seems like a Feanorians slash dwarves.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mission. So yeah. I do think we can push things back into 10, but I don't think it would go all the way back into 9. Okay,
10 would, but that, so that would mean leave takings and battle as a whole would be happening 10 through 4 through 13. So we still have that, the four episodes for all that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means it's this middle segment. Hang on, let's go back to the beginning segment then. In the beginning segment, we've got the three primary threads, right? Our three primary threads are the developments out east, right? Galadriel's, like, missionary trip, right, is one major thread. You've got Maedhros talking people into the battle idea is another major thread. And then you've got Húrin's arrival and establishment, his, you know, his trip to Gondolin, his return from Gondolin, his becoming Lord of Dor Lomond, and his marrying Morwen, right? His whole early plot line there. So the Húrin's major life changes, Maedhros's moving forward of the big plan, and Galadriel's expedition into the east.
Yes.
Those are the major things that we're establishing in the first chunk of the season. Right. Okay. That, I'm just, what I'm thinking about is the pacing of these things.
It's good.
That's good. It's the middle bit. It's episode 5 to 9 that I have the bigger questions about, and like the impact on episodes 5 to 9.
Mm-hmm.
The summit feels late. Or rather, one thing that I can't help but notice is how spread out the whole Maedhros plot is.
So what I did to start with was say, Húrin gets to show up in every episode. He's our main character for the season. He can have his own individual storyline in every episode. Maybe not the main storyline, but he's going to appear.
Yeah.
Probably. Like, you know, whatever. For Maedhros and the Union of Maedhros and that whole plan, I said, okay, every other episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I just put him in all the even episodes to start with. And the reason why is that that's not our primary storyline. It's our secondary storyline compared to Húrin. I know it's the Nirnaeth. It's the planning of the Nirnaeth. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
But it's the thing that's happening. It's not necessarily...
Right. So Maedhros is not the main character and Fingon is not the main character. Is where I'm going with this. So character development, story-wise, they can probably deal with about half the screen time.
Right. That makes sense. Right.
So in the early part of the season, what I did with Maedhros was talks to his brothers, talks to Fingon, talks to the whole group, gets everybody on board. That's about how far he needs to get by the middle of the season, because if the summit is any earlier, why isn't the battle starting? Like, at some point, you've done everything you're going to do to get ready if you plan too soon.
Right. Well, first of all, let's keep in mind, the battle is going to be taking place less than 5 years. So, in other words, it's going to be like a day and a half after the summit, for as far as the elves are concerned. So,
right. But for the pacing of the season, if we agree to do the battle and get everybody on board by episode 4,
okay,
then by episode 10, people are like, didn't you guys all agree to a battle or something? Like,
right. Where's the battle already? Okay, yeah, I hear you.
So that's why I let it pace out in the beginning. I didn't think there was any rush to get to the summit.
I think what I'm hoping for, I'm not disagreeing. Like, but what I'm missing is, although I agree that Mythos and Fingon aren't our main characters and aren't the focus of the story that we're telling, theirs is still the major story of the season, essentially. Right? I mean, it is the thing that's happening, as we say. And there are going to be things that will... I mean, like, we know there are going to be other things that are going to be happening in between. These are the things that... I agree, these are the two things that should be on screen pre-summit, right? Mythos talking to his brothers... Mither is talking to Fingon.
But we've totally also discussed having Hurin and Fingon sit down and have a discussion.
Well, that's exactly it. That's what I was going
to
suggest.
But to my mind, that would be between Fingon and Mither's conversation and the summit. So that would be an episode 5 thing.
Which is fine.
Where Fingon would visit him. I just hadn't put it on the...
Yeah. No, it's good. I just want to make sure that I'm... I want to make... I guess what
it
I want to see is the momentum. Go ahead.
It also wouldn't kill us to have Mythos spend some time amongst the humans to be like,
yeah,
I need more of these guys.
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, we talked
the
about
few
the possibility
of them that I had in
Mythos memory.
They're not, not going to, like, I need to get me some of this.
Right. I had one once. He was kind of cool, but yeah.
Well, there was a small contingent of them at Hemring, but
exactly, like the descendants of that guy. Who was it? Was what's his face? Right, the guy who gets impersonated. Whose name I'm blanking.
Umlock.
Right. Exactly.
Him and his small cadre of dude, like whoever was in his, because remember the Estalad culture had these small bands roving around that would meet together. So his band.
Yeah.
Went to Hemring.
Yep, exactly. So he had a guy once, but So no, I totally agree. I just want to make sure I don't want to lose sight for like our sake and thinking about the. I think there's a sort of a danger in just having the the blue line kind of empty for long stretches, because it is, that's the story. In a sense, that's a storyline that has to make sense from one end of the season to the next. Like, that is the story that drives the whole season. So we need to make sure that the flow of that is going to make sense, even if we're going to be telling it from a distance or even skipping bits of it and only hearing about them later on or whatever. We can do that because we choose to focus on Hurin instead. I just need to make sure. So the other things that need to happen, in between, say, so I agree, it begins with him talking to his brothers, right? Talking to Fingon is probably step 2. But we're also going to be they're going to have the summit. They're going to invite people to, like, invitations have to go out to the summit. And there has to be an explanation. Like, people are going to come to the summit and get pitched cold on this idea, right? Like, the idea will have been spread, and then they'll be coming to talk about whether or not to do it. Most everybody coming to the summit already knows more or less where they stand on things. So bunches of conversations have to happen earlier on, and Fingon would be helping with that, I would think, if he's on board.
That suggests that the summit has to get pushed back until later. If you want a lot of pre-work to go into it.
Well, What the pre-work that would need to go in, we would need to reach out to Nargothrond. We would need to reach out to Doriath. We would need to reach out to Círdan, right?
Yes.
That's the major, like from a geographical standpoint, like that's the major thing that needs, stuff that needs to happen, right?
Right. So that I didn't put a box in for, but was supposed to happen in episode 5, was that we would be starting our Doriath and Nargothrond storylines in episode 5 so that we could prepare for the summit.
Right.
Let me ask something about this summit.
Yes.
Is this summit a... This is where we decide what the plan is summit, or is this a who's on board with this summit?
It's first and foremost who's on board, and if you're not on board, let me try to convince you to be on board.
Okay.
And then let's plan. Because we're not going to be hanging out together in one place very much. So we need to emerge from the summit with a pretty clear idea of what's going to be happening. And that, of course, is going to be part of convincing people, right? Like that this is not a mad idea.
Well, I mean, maybe, but it's, it sounds kind of like two separate stories. So if you needed, if you wanted to expand that plot line so it felt more like more stuff was happening to move that forward, that's one thing that could be done, is just to have the summit take place over a longer period of time.
Like split it over 2 episodes?
Yeah, you could do that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the first episode is the one which goes badly, and Orodreth storms out, and Mabelung and Peleg look
awkward.
So right. We're not going to bring the armies of Doriath.
Right. And Gil-galad is like, people, don't do this to me again. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Because if we don't have... So let me ask this question another way. If the basic logistical planning... the basic strategic planning for the battle plan does not happen at the summit. When does it happen, and how are the plans promulgated?
Right? Yeah, so I think that there
something
has
should
to
happen at the summit, right?
Yeah, I feel
they have a huge communication problem. They kind of have to.
Yeah.
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 Also, Mithras's whole deal in getting people on board and getting them to join is kind of predicated on the, it's okay, you guys, I have a plan.
Right. Right. Exactly. Like,
so he's coming to the summit fully prepared with his plan.
Yes.
And he's trying to get people on board with that. Now, I'm not saying the plan's not adaptable depending on who joins the,
it's gotta be right.
Yeah. Obviously, like it's gotta be a flexible plan, but he has to be able to stand up there and say something that convinces people like, hey, now is the time, we should get on board with this and do it now.
Right.
Instead of just saying, so, right, Morgoth, been there the last 400 years. We could have attacked him at any point in time and we never did. But now we're going to do it.
Today's like, right. How is this not Fingolfin all over again?
Yeah. Right. He has to have something he's saying, and it can't just be, well, Luthien did it, so like let's give it a go.
Right. Right.
So he has a plan.
Yes, clearly. Yeah. Clearly.
Well, and his plan could include everybody who's at the summit. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is what this battle would look like if everybody's on board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, once everybody turns out that everybody is not on board, in fact, the two most numerous armies that could show up, elvish armies that could show up, are in fact not going to be there. That changes the math. And so now, how do we figure out how to do this without them?
I gotta think Mithros has come with like 2 different binders to distribute.
Sure.
Or maybe 4 different binders.
But we have to discuss what that looks like.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because unfortunately, we can't just plan the near knight that's going to show up on screen. We also have to plan the near knight that
Mithras draws up.
What the Union of Mithras was actually planning on having happen in this battle, which apparently are 2 totally different things.
Yeah.
And we can have, and we should have, our other heroic characters have input.
Yeah.
And have agency in what, like, especially Hurin.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Hurin should have input on what actually happens on the battlefield, because otherwise he just got duped by Mithras. Into getting himself captured.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's how we would want to show characters who are pledging support. They're not just be like, oh, whatever your plan is, we'll totally show up for it. Like, the folk of Brethel are not known for having that attitude towards anyone in life.
Right.
Like, that's just really not their personalities. Right. So yeah, I agree that it is a summit to get counsel from everyone involved. But it's just, he didn't show up with, so what do you think we should do, guys? Like, that's
right. Oh, of course not. Yeah. Of course not. I imagine that during the secondary planning meeting, he's doing a lot of yes and
kind of
leadership.
Mm-hmm. Dave, sorry, what were we going to say?
I was wondering, wouldn't some of the recruitment have happened before? Like, I'm trying to imagine, like, the representatives from Doriath showing up and then finding out what this was all about and being like, well, that was a wasted trip.
Exactly.
I would have to. I would have to imagine that, like, either the recruitment happens on the ground, like he goes around, Mithras goes and visits and says, like, here's why I want you to come to the summit, and either he gets his no then, and they just don't show up, or at least like, maybe people are showing up and they haven't made up their minds. And they're at least open to it. But I have to think that he has some intelligence, right? Ahead of time, like, if he's a competent ruler, he knows ahead of time, like,
right,
here's the people that are really on board. Here's the people we have to persuade.
Yes.
Here's the people that I think probably won't join.
And that's where it's a joint effort with Fingon.
Right.
Is that Fingon's very much involved in that part of the process.
Right.
Yes.
And he might think he can persuade or Dreth.
Yes. I would vote that Fingon basically tells Mithras that he believes he can deliver Ora Dreth. Like, he believes he can get Ora Dreth to show up, right?
And if he can, and if Ora Dreth is on board, they think that they might be able to get Thingol.
Yeah, Thingol is the long shot. Right. Nobody really believes that that's going to happen. Even Fingon isn't going to be confident that he could do
it. But maybe the change goes from Mablung and Beleg show up to deliver the message that no help from Doriath is coming, changes to, we'll see what we can do.
Because they will see what they can do. Like,
right.
Mablung and Beleg themselves are going to be like, actually, this kind of sounds like fun. We hate to miss this, right? Even though Thingol's not into it, we kind of are, right?
Right. They were sent to deliver Thingol's, of course, very, you know, respectful decline to this party. But they, in fact, are like, do we really not want to be part of this?
It kind of sounds a little awesome, yes.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see what we can do. What we can do is, we'll be there.
We'll be there. Exactly. Maybe we'll bring a couple friends.
Thanks.
But yeah. Yeah. Honestly, like, in some ways, of course, that is like, that counts as a phenomenal success. Like, way better than anyone could have expected, really, from Doriath.
And later on, when you add the Easterlings and the dwarves to the board, you can see Mithras swapping out groups of his mind. Like, well, it's okay that Doriath didn't show up because I've got a bunch of
now we've got these humans. Yeah, yeah.
Or these humans or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
So, like, you can see him mathematically being like, okay, I didn't need them anyway.
Yeah.
At the end, which should, like, reassure that they're prepared for this battle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we still feel the loss of that group.
Yeah, but I agree. The real drama, Ora Dreth is the real drama, right? Mm-hmm. Fingon believes correctly that he can convince him to come. And all he can, but he tells Mithras, like, I can't promise how he's going to vote. Like, and it's very likely he's not going to do it. But we have a chance. I can get him there, and we have a chance. And if he says yes, it's a big swing vote, right? You know, as you say, Dave, it seems a little bit much to imagine he could actually, like, that would then lead to Doriath coming in full. But again, it would make if he does, if Orodreth does come in, then it's basically Thingol is the only holdout, which of course has not stopped him before, but still, like, it puts a little bit of pressure on him in some sense. But of course the drama is going to be, he's going to come, but he's going to say no. Right.
But Gwyndor is there in his entourage, and Gwyndor is saying yes, and Gwyndor eventually is going to get a contingent of guys to come.
Yes.
So there, even in the firm no from Orodreth, there is a little bit of wiggle room.
Just as we're doing with Doriath too, with Beleg and Eblung.
I think that you can come away from the summit meeting with that went well.
Right.
Right. So Gwyndor is there at the summit meeting and Orodreth is storming out and Gwyndor is kind of like turning around looking back like...
Right. This puts me in an awkward place because I kind of love it, right? And I definitely want in for personal reasons. And then we have the awkwardness with him in Fenduelas almost immediately, actually, could be setting in.
We'll have like a moment halfway through the episode where we think, I think we got him. We've swung him.
Right.
Says something during the meeting that makes them think that they've won him over, and then the next scene is the devastating, like, nope.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and even and that maybe we've got him could be from Gwyndor. Like, oh, yes, we got somebody from his entourage.
Gwyndor gets a little too excited.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of actually liking the idea, not of dragging out like the summit alone as two full episodes of nothing but summit, but just basically because I'm thinking about how do we communicate the battle plans? Because I agree. I think it's really important that we have. We talked about wanting to bring the audience to the place where they genuinely believe the elves can win, right? Mm-hmm. They think this is going to go well. Which means we need to convince them of the plan, the audience of the plan, right? So I feel like we need to have that, this could be done very badly, but we need to do the tactics. Like we need to, it's like, the audience needs to hear Mythros's pitch also about what the plan is, like what Mythros's plan is and how it's going to work. And there's no other place other than here because, you know, Nick, as you said, they've got some serious communication issues. They're going to need to leave the summit with the basics of the plan, you know, which can be refined with things like the Easterlings happen and stuff. You know, messengers can be thinking, can be like, oh, wow, this big news just in from Mythros. You know, there's now like 100,000 humans on the plane. Like, okay,
right.
That's different
and,
now.
Well, and also somebody like, because if at this point the dwarves are not yet on board, then people can ask and cannot be asking him, well, what about the dragon? He says, look, let me worry about the dragon.
Right.
I've got some irons in the fire on that. We'll if I can take care of the dragon, that's going to be the first thing that happens.
Right.
If I can take care of that, this is what happens moving forward.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. No, that's,
as he always intended, even if he couldn't get the dwarves fully on board, to be getting them to arm and armor his guys.
Yes.
So that they could handle the dragon.
And and as for where else can we have that kind of discussion, when the Easterlings agree to join the Union of Mythras, he needs to pitch them as well, right?
True. That's true.
And that would be the opportunity for the refined plans. Because at that point, he knows exactly who he's got in the West on his side. Well, he doesn't know about Gondolin, but...
Right.
Minus Gondolin, he knows what he's got over there. And then for the East, if they join, that's the biggest part of the force. So they would be playing a pretty significant role. And he's already got the dwarves recruited to some extent with the siege equipment, probably. And now it's just a matter of getting their army involved, which would be the last step of the process. But we do have that later scene where we could bring the audience further along into the battle plans.
Right, that's true. So I'm just thinking about, Nick, I'm just reflecting on what you said about two storylines, right? And if the, sort of first or primary summit scene, or summit episode, right, essentially culminates with Ordreth walking out, right? Then we could still do, we could still kind of wrap up the summit in the following episode, cementing plans and basically dealing with, like, okay, now how do we cope with this reality? And Mythra, because I would kind of like to see sort of Mythra's holding it together. You know what I mean? When the swing vote doesn't go their way, it's not a crushing blow, but it's not great, right? Yeah, I think we wanna, we might. Sorry. It's fun watching you move these around in real time, Marie. It's okay. Yeah. Especially if we put the romance of Rihanna and who are there, right? Well, you know what that would pair really nicely with? Gwyndor and Fyndulas. Mm-hmm. What do you think? We have the two, the two relationships going in different directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
And do you want those in the same episode or just in neighboring episodes?
Well, we could. So I'm thinking Gwyndor is actually one of the things that I was thinking I could see doing some like spillover from the summit into the next episode. Because if the first summit episode is primarily focused on the drama of like, what is everybody going to do? And are you in? Right. And all the discussion, because there's so many angles to discuss and so many different characters to involve in that. Gwyndor and Ordreth, right? The Doriath dudes, Húrin and Fingon talking about things and with Mythros. And there's a lot there, right? Which would then culminate in Ordreth saying no, but Gwyndor being like, you know, I really want in. In episode 7, then, we could have the departure. So, like, Ordreth is leaving in the beginning of episode 7, but this is when Gwyndor is like, basically comes to them and says, look, or, you know, my king is out. I'm not going to undermine him, but I want in, right? And then that would lead, he could, Fyndulas could be along with them at the summit, and he and Fyndulas could have their thing right there, right? Where his choice is made, and she knows that he's making it, and they have their falling out, right? That means we don't even have to go back to Nargothrond. We just have him show up later on. Like, he's wrapped at that point, right? And that way we do all of the little mini Gwyndor arc in two episodes there in the summit. But the second summit episode wouldn't be as intense. We could still do planning, right? We could still have, like, Mythros and Fingon and Húrin especially getting together with maybe Gwyndor and Beleg and Mablung, right? And basically saying, like, okay, Nargothrond's out. You guys tell me Thingol's realistically out. So let me tell you the revised plan, right? Here's the second set of binders, right, that I prepared against this contingency, right? All is not lost, right? So we can show Mythros showing some good leadership, but at the same time, the majority of the emphasis in that episode can be on the personal stories, right? Can be kind of all bracketed by Gwyndor and Fyndulas and Rhiannon and Huor. Would Rhiannon and Huor come along? Would they be there? Could we all be in the same place?
I mean, Huor should definitely be at that summit.
Mm. Right. He should.
Not sure why Rhiannon is there.
Why not?
Unless Morwen is
there. Brings her. Like, you know, she comes along with Morwen. Morwen would come, right?
Sure. I can give you Morwen being there. I'm wondering
why she would bring Rhiannon.
Yeah.
Why not? Kids,
right? Morwen and Húrin have kids by this point, don't they?
No, Turin should already be born, yeah.
Yeah.
Look, so then, if little Turin isn't a handful, who would be, right? I mean, come on. Right? You'd need a... because
Morwen wants to be able to...
She wants to be in the summit. They need a babysitter.
Oh, so Rhiannon's there as the babysitter. Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. And
to babysit Turin, right? I mean, like, come on. Who, like, talk about your bad part-time jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Turin's babysitter? Yeah. Can you even imagine that?
And she gets to show her matronly qualities to the guy that she's really interested in.
She's also motivated to come along because Hoor's coming, right? So, you know, like, it doesn't
as long as it can organically make sense that all these people are there, because recall that this meeting is happening on Tol Sirion in the ruins of a tower next to Finrod's grave. Like, this is not exactly prime real estate.
Yeah, but like,
it's not that far away.
It wouldn't be unreasonable for these people to bring their families with them.
Right. No. There aren't spa facilities, but I mean, it's fine. Like, you know, there's plenty of room.
It's not far from the Pools of Ivrin, so
yeah,
I definitely wanted to use that location with the Finduilis story.
So you're saying maybe there are spa facilities? Yes, that's what you're suggesting.
Spa facilities at the Pools of Ivrin.
What could be better?
Clearly, Gwyndor and Finduilis are going to go hang out there.
It's not that far from Rivel's Well. Oh, wait.
Yeah. They're not going to go hang out there.
Which is, by the way, I think where Glaurung winds up holding up when he gets hurt. Because while he doesn't want to fight, he still doesn't want to necessarily abandon his wormlings.
Yeah. 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 No, this is great. Okay. So, yeah, I like the double romance, or the romance and the anti-romance going on there in episode 7. Accompanying the kind of the backside of the, it's not even, because like the summit is pretty, it's not exactly that the summit even lasts two episodes. The summit is done when Orodreth leaves, right?
So it's like aftermath.
It's the aftermath of the summit, I think, is probably even the better way to say it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The aftermath of the summit, they're all still there. Well, they're all still there except Orodreth, but the rest of them are still there. But yeah, Gwyndor. I think that works. And then, all right. Let's, no GD Tower, and the Cauldron of Evil is not going to be repurposed as a hot tub. Okay. This spa is living customers only. Now, let's go for the Easterling. Right, Easterlings here, the Galadriel plotline, and see, because I'm feeling better about most of the rest of it, the overall shape now, because we can, as far as Hurin is concerned, looking at the revisions you've been making to those lines, Marie, if we focus on Rhian and Huor's getting married in episode 7, or at least engaged. We can have Lilith born in episode 8 and die in episode 9. Basically.
It depends how you want to tell her story.
Lilith's story?
Yes. Yeah. Like, because obviously when she dies, it's the death of laughter, but is like her brief life bringing laughter? Is she in some way this ray of light that shows up and then we snuff it out?
That's one of the things that I really love about this. That coming right after the romance of Rhian and Huor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everything is sunshine and rainbows in Dor Lomon for two episodes, right until the plague, right?
An exceptionally pretty child is generally considered a very good omen.
Yeah, exactly. People. Exactly. And again, following hard on the romance, I mean, with Rhian and Huor, that's great. I mean, I think that builds this like delightful momentum of cheerfulness, which then of course gets horribly crushed by the plague in the next episode. So, yes, I do like establishing laughter, you know, I could even see.
It was just, I wasn't sure what we were emphasizing. If it was the briefness of her life, having her be born and die in the same episode would make a lot more sense.
Well,
but if it's first there was laughter and now it is snuffed out, that's different.
I think that. I mean, she's three, and so the brevity of her life is still going to be it's not like we're going to get to know her super well before she dies.
But, right.
Yes. But no, to have the brilliant joy and laughter that is connected, that is like, you know, associated with the epoch of Lilith's brief life, and then laughter dies, and like it's not going to take long in episode 9 for people to reflect on how short the season of laughter was, basically, even if it's a whole episode, right? This would make... Would this make Morrowind pregnant at the summit? With Lilith?
It depends on the passage of time.
Although that would make a lot more sense why Rian... That would help add to the reasons why Rian's Rian coming. Would be there yeah. to help.
Yep.
Yeah. If she's pregnant and watching... Young Turin. Mm-hmm. Am I the only one who wants to make preschool Turin like a complete nightmare to watch?
Oh,
like,
no. This checks out.
The series of really, really bad. I mean, can you imagine how bad the choices Turin at the age of 4 would be making? I mean,
but he's still so charismatic and adorable that everybody just loves him anyway.
Yeah. Yeah,
my son has this impact on people. He is a ball of destruction who just demolishes everything in his path.
Yeah.
He's 2.
Yeah.
And but he, you know, he's a 40-pound little bruiser and he just obliterates everything. But he's so cute and he just smiles
yep.
so broadly as no, he that's, rips that's... apart your stuff. That it's really, really hard to get mad at him over
it's Turin in a nutshell. It's Turin's whole career right there. That's it.
Yeah, that is Turin.
Okay. I will point out then that we're putting Rian at the 15 to 16-year-old age range during this time period.
If anyone's counting.
Right. Well, that's the thing. As long as we didn't tie in the birth of Lilith, we could say whenever it was. But if it's... definitely very clearly before she's born, then Rian can be no older than 16.
We don't necessarily have to marry the moth in episode
right.
7.
So I am fine with showing a romance there with a later wedding.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to avoid the child bride situation. That
I hear you.
Painting ourselves into the corner.
I hear you. Well, Rian is a challenge in this regard, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... It's
she also wouldn't be considered a child in the culture in which she lives.
That's
so.
The other thing I'm having.
I understand
struggle with,
that,
but yeah.
But we have to put an actress on screen.
Yeah,
16 is not completely egregious in a pre-modern society, right?
No,
right?
No, and yeah, and I think there's.
Yes, let's not cast a 16-year-old.
No, or right,
25-year-old playing young.
Yeah. This game's like. Safe. We're gonna play this totally safe.
How old was what's her face when she played the Targaryen in Game of Thrones?
Well, okay, and I was well, no, I can't even say that. I was about to say that. Well, in our show, they're gonna keep their clothes on, but then like Nienor, so maybe not.
We are, in fact, going to need an intimacy coordinator for this show.
Yeah, we sure are.
Well, we were going to need that last season. Like, for sure. You know.
For sure. For sure.
Is 4-year-old Turin, is he already adopting names for himself?
Oh, he's got to have a bunch of names already. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 4-year-old Turin has to have, like, 3 different nicknames. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, right, yeah. So it's fine. It's fine. We can the wedding, the actual wedding doesn't, because again, the importance is the importance of the pairing, or the interest of the pairing of Huor and Rian and Gwyndor and Finduilas is just to see their romances go in the different directions, right?
Right, right.
So like, we don't need to like hold a wedding at, you know, the ruins of, yes, Tol Sirion, which
sounds good.
Unless the, yeah, spa facilities are quite nice, probably not where they envision their honeymoon anyway. So, but yes, yes. Okay, that's fine. That's good. So the wedding can happen off screen, and we don't even have to be real clear about that.
It's just
so,
sometime before the battle. Yeah.
Sometime before the battle.
So yeah, by episode 10, they've gotten married.
Yes.
But that's fine, because after the death of Liliath, she can be what, 19 now,
right? We could, if we wanted to go as far as this, since 10 is sort of the beginning of the battle, and mm-hmm, certainly in any case we're not going to have massive quantities of time happening between episode 10 and 13, right?
Right,
the pace is going to be relatively quick in there, and I know people were concerned about Rian's gestation period. We could have Rian visibly pregnant at the plague, the way we've timed it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Theoretically.
So, right. So they got married sometime.
At some point. Some, like, yeah, in the episode 8-ish, between 8 yeah, and 9, mm-hmm, kind of area. And then when the, with the concern of the, I mean, and like, you know, Huor hovering over his already apparently pregnant young wife while the plague is on and everyone's dying,
yeah,
around,
like,
them.
That's terrifying.
You know, yeah. I mean, would be, and she lived. Fortunately, you know, their story doesn't end tragically in this episode. So, but anyway, right, yeah. So like that, yeah, I could see that working.
Okay, all right, I'm fine with this. Okay. I'm totally fine with 19-year-old Rian being married and having a baby and planning her family. That is totally cool.
That's right. Again, yes.
Just wanted to make sure that 13-year-old Rian wasn't doing.
No, we're fine. No problems. No problems. And as you say, we don't have to jump up and down and trumpet the years and everybody's ages exactly. So, mm-hmm, but yeah. Okay. But anyway, back to Galadriel. Because how the shape of that plot fits in,
yeah,
is,
yeah,
the thing that is, I think, the last thing that we need to really sort of settle here. Okay. So, the points that you have here in as far as like what she's doing, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We've got her learning about the men in the East in episode 2, going East, meeting with the Emperor of Bree. I can't even tell you how much pleasure that phrase gives me. I just love it so much. Meeting with the Emperor of Bree. We get introduced to the Ulfang Bor political situation. You're saying, you know, perhaps then after that, the Easterlings traveling west in the midst. Their arrival then would be right after. I like their arrival being right after, like, right at or after. Because episode 7 is kind of full with aftermath and romance, right? Mm-hmm. So if episode 8 basically becomes the eucatastrophic arrival of the Easterlings in the west, right? That's the perfect, like, momentum builder for Mythros, right? Mm-hmm. We had a setback. Didn't look great there for a little while. The swing vote didn't go the way we were hoping it would go. But boom, look at this, right? This is totally happening. The Easterlings are here. So he, Mythros, would be meeting with them there in episode 8, right? So he would have time to get back from the summit after episode 7. And so then we see him in the East, and we could introduce the Easterlings basically from the perspective of the Feanorians, right? Anyway, that happens in episode 8. Yeah. But let's see, remind me how the intrigue goes. One of the things I'm struggling with is that our conversation on this was a long time ago now.
Right, well, right. So we have two leaders, Bor and Allfang.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the Emperor, who is somebody different from both of them.
Yes.
The Emperor has to publicly really like Allfang a lot because he's like his right-hand man, the general leading the armies. He has a lot of power and a lot of control and a lot of land, or, you know, whatever it is you have lots of.
Yeah.
They may have just had a super successful campaign.
Right. He's their war recently. Leader. Right.
Exactly.
He's Julius Caesar coming off of the conquest of Gaul.
He's the great general. Yes.
Right. So Allfang has public support from the people and from the Emperor. Like, the Emperor's like, yes, Allfang, best guy ever. But privately, the Emperor's like, Allfang, definitely gonna depose me someday.
Right. Yeah.
It's Saul and David, actually, to use a different
right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, exactly.
This is not gonna end well for me.
Or speaking of trouble. Julius Caesar, yes, exactly. Right. Yes, yes.
So when Galadriel shows up with a plan, Allfang's appeal is, oh, lots of free land over there, you say.
Right.
People who don't know anything about us, but there could be place for us, right?
Yes.
So he's interested in her idea. The Emperor is thrilled that he's interested in her idea because it means he'll leave. And Bor is Allfang's friend who gets drawn into it all. And we were going to make him have a bunch of chariots, I believe.
Yeah,
Bor was the chariot guy.
They're a separate people group that are chariot. Yeah. They're like the auxiliary tiers.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Worst case scenario for this, for the Emperor, worst case scenario, Allfang goes off and is never seen again.
They're all horribly destroyed.
Worst
or
case scenario. Yeah, worst, right.
And that's not horrible because then he's lost his rival. And his rival, by the way, who just settled things so there's peace in his realm and he can prosper and rebuild without a problem. Yeah.
Right. And you know, the next best thing is client kingdom over there.
Yeah.
You know, best case scenario, Allfang goes over there and just takes the whole place over in the Emperor's name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Done. It's a win-win-win-win-win situation.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why the Emperor is very much amenable to Galadriel's ideas.
Right.
And because it solves his Allfang problem. And Allfang realizes that his only way up words in this empire is to take
he's
out the Emperor.
Right, right.
Or take out the Emperor. And he's apparently not interested in a coup situation at this time.
At least it's the path of much greater resistance, and he would much rather... This is a very much more attractive opportunity for him.
Exactly.
Yep.
So Allfang, it seems to be a pretty decent guy, the way we've created him.
Yeah.
And he goes off and then becomes the victim of a more... close to home.
His own coup from within.
Yes.
Right.
Because apparently while he's a great military leader, he might not be the greatest dad.
Right. Yes. And so Sauron works on Uldor specifically, right?
Well, yes. Although we were kind of waffling back and forth on how much we see Sauron interact
with
Mr. Uldor at all.
Yeah.
Like, it was very much it could be Sauron, or it could just be, this is what happens when you're a terrible dad and you raise your sons to be your military successors.
It's the plague all over again.
Exactly. And we were going to show a scene at the end with Sauron and the Emperor of Bree to show that Sauron did have an in there and his fingerprints were on what was going on here.
Yeah.
So did he orchestrate the whole thing? Probably not. But did he nudge things or push Uldor in that direction? Also, probably yes.
Right. But we were going to make that really low key, basically.
I think so, because I think we had discussed, like, well, Sauron could, like, in disguise, join the army and, like, travel with them and be Uldor's buddy who, like, convinces them to do all this. And then we were like, or we could just not do that.
Right.
And we decided on the let's just not do that,
right.
I believe. Again, with the not being too heavy-handed in how we tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's not clear to me is when the betrayal of his father happens. Like, I understand that the Easterling army turning against their supposed allies is going to happen during
right.
the near
so
life.
That's
but
the...
when does Alfang die?
Yes. And so what is Uldor's? Because so here's the problem with having Sauron not involved, right? Mm-hmm. Is that we have to then imagine that the betrayal by Uldor and ultimately the undermining of the entire, you know, Western Front or Eastern Front, sorry, of the battle just kind of happens, you know, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that feels weak, right? I mean, if Uldor is not set up for this specifically, like, why would he even do this? Like, why would the betrayal of Maedhros happen at all? I mean, like, what right. does he have, what so does he stand to gain from that?
We had suggested that the people in Bree did have some, like, legends about Morgoth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Morgoth was not unknown to them.
Right.
So when Galadriel's like, yes, you can come over, there's plenty of land in Beleriand, and you can, like, join our just cause as we fight this evil guy up in the north. They might think that fighting the evil guy up in the north is maybe not the best idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be Uldor's motivation, which would still bring it all back to Morgoth and Sauron.
Right.
Maybe we don't fight God, in other words.
Right, exactly. Because we know that Morgoth went to the east and established a connection with humans way back. And
so
he's still that guy
yeah.
to these
let
people.
Let me back this up one more step then and ask this question. What is Sauron's purpose here? We had him kind of setting up on his own. We had him beginning, last season was the beginning of his transition away from service of Morgoth, right? Beginning to question, watching Fingolfin wound him, right? That moment of him, of like the first time that Sauron experiences something like scorn for Morgoth, right? In the battle with Fingolfin. And right after that, we see Sauron setting up on his own as, you know, running the Dark Lord playbook for the first time as Thu in Tol Ngarahoth, that is short-lived, right, thanks to Luthien and Huon. But when he goes off, I think that we introduced questions last season about the status of his loyalty. So to what extent, because, I mean, so basically there seems to me there are three options for, like, where Sauron's head is at this point, right? Either A, he's still a kind of sleeper agent for Morgoth, trying to still do good for the boss, and maybe kind of recover his own reputation, which he has to think must have taken a hit from the whole girl and her dog situation. So either, again, he's still an active sleeper agent on the eastern side for Sauron, and hoping to, like, later on brag about, so what'd you think of that betrayal on the battlefield? Kind of cunning for me to arrange that, wasn't it? You're welcome, boss, right? So that would be one version. The other version is he's still thinking of his own, on his own. He's still setting up for himself, and he is cultivating the Emperor, and he wants to eliminate Ulfang because he thinks Ulfang doesn't want anything to do with him. So he's going to get rid of Ulfang. So he's going to encourage Uldor to, you know, he's going to plant the seeds with Uldor and just kind of hope that stuff all, you know, goes to crap on the other side of the mountains, right? Morgoth and you know, Gothmog can take care of business over there, right? Ulfang has no idea what he's getting into on the other side of the mountains. So that's fine. But I've got the Emperor here and I'm just going to focus on that and I don't care what happens over there. Or neither. Or he's just, like, you know, hiding out in the Barrow Downs, licking his wounds and doing necromancy and you know, hanging out with...
What if it's both?
Or, yeah. I mean...
Yeah, the thing is, I can't really...
Sauron seems like a both sort of guy, right?
He is. I can't really see the way we would have the conversation between him and Aldor, though. Like, some guy comes up to Aldor and says, you know, what would be really great is if after you were out of court, you took your dad's place and, like, no one questioned it because who was there? There are no witnesses or something. Like, how do you plant that idea in a non-obvious way? And
you
not
wouldn't plant
like,
that.
You know
you
what
would
be
plant...
great is patricide.
right. No, you don't lead with patricide, right? Okay. You start with, like, wow, are you underappreciated, right?
Yeah, okay.
You know,
fair. So yeah. Sauron's better at this.
right.
But would we want to show any of that kind of conversation on screen is where I'm going.
I don't know, but I'm not even thinking about it on screen yet. I'm just trying to understand
know,
for sure what the story is.
But if there's nothing on screen, then like...
It doesn't really happen.
Did it even happen? Yeah.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. The betrayal of the Easterlings has to be either Sauron's victory or Morgoth's.
Yes.
One of them has to be pulling the strings behind that. And if it's Sauron's, we got to figure out his motivations, obviously. Morgoth, less so. He wants to win. But if we are too coy with how that's done, then it's gonna be unsatisfying. It looks like we just did it just 'cause.
Yeah. So the aftermath of the Near Ninth, that is the issue of the reward of the Easterlings, suggests very explicitly, though the mechanism is never explained, like Tolkien never explains who approaches whom and when those conversations happen, right? We just know that even before they come over the mountains, some of them were already in the service of Morgoth secretly, right? How? Who recruited them? When did that happen? We have no idea, right? Tolkien never explains any of that. But that they did what they did in order to receive a promised reward from Morgoth, which ultimately they were denied, right, is a part of Tolkien's story. And it makes sense. Like, it's, I think if we don't have Uldor knowingly committing treachery for this hope of receiving a reward from Morgoth, it's going to be hard to explain. It's going to make it look like we're just trying to say that, like, you know, unfortunately, like, you know, a patricidal coup happened to occur at this time, which was really bad luck, right? And that just doesn't, that seems like a weak story, and it seems odd. It just seems kind of a strain to imagine that. Easier to imagine somebody proposing this to Uldor. So, like, there are only two seeds that need to be planted. I mean, assuming the dude is enough of a baseline jerk to begin with, right? Then you only need the two seeds planted. Like, boy, aren't you underappreciated by your dad? And isn't he a really bad father? And then B, if you were in charge and could deliver this victory, you would receive this reward and we'd become would become the ruler of an empire that would make the emperor back over there, you know, look like a local, you know, client king. So, the promise of power, if he can deliver, and the, like, riling up against his, you know, and like, so, you know, so he's riled up against his dad already and only need a little bit of a push to say, like, okay, there's this big possibility and dad is the only thing standing in the way because dad won't even listen to this. Right. And anyway, my dad's a jerk and I'm resentful anyhow. So I'm going to betray my father. I'm going to kill my father. And then I'm going to take over the army. And then I'm going to deliver victory into the hands of the God of the North, who is promising to make me king.
Right. And that's the part that we can't lose, because the coup is one thing.
Yes.
The betrayal is a second thing.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
The reward for the betrayal is very clearly and explicitly I think Morgoth's going to reward me on this.
Yeah, yeah.
And why would you think that unless somebody told you that?
Exactly. And who's going to tell him that? Sauron seems the obvious candidate to tell him that. Right.
Right. And it's true that Sauron is losing respect for Morgoth, but he hasn't, like, quit Angband entirely.
Right. He didn't, like, he didn't, you know,
he's not
rage
against...
quit Angband. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So he would definitely still be supportive of whatever Morgoth's up to, even if he's not actively involved himself right now.
Well, and remember, Nick, as you were saying, from the Emperor of Bree's perspective, this is a win-win-win situation. Sauron would have the same point of view, right? For Sauron, it's even more of a win-win-win situation.
Right.
Because he doesn't care at all about these people. But, like, the balance of the equation, as you were saying, is in favor of further power of the Emperor, whom he's already working on. And if, as a very substantial bonus, he also gets back on Morgoth's good side by, you know, in the process of feathering his own new nest, then awesome.
Okay. So... we would want to show Sauron as a character in the Bree scenes.
I think so.
At some point. So then the only question is he clearly Sauron, that the audience knows it's Sauron? Or is it some guy in disguise who, surprise, later turns out to have been Sauron all along?
I think it could just be Sauron.
Okay.
I don't see any reason why not. Especially since, I mean, like, the bargain he offers Uldor is just a straight-up devil's bargain. Right. Like, you do this bad thing, you know, you for the low, low price of betraying your father and then your new allies, you will be made Emperor of Beleriand. Straight up. Right. And because he calculates that Uldor is enough of a jerk to say yes to that bargain and enough of a dupe to say yes to that bargain.
I kind of like some guy, though.
You kind of like some guy.
Well, here's a question.
They could meet on a raft in Lake Evendale. Sorry.
Here's the question. Would Galadriel recognize him if she saw him?
I think we've established no. Galadriel does not recognize strangers on rafts who she should
no.
totally recognize.
No,
that's true. But, has she ever met
Sauron?
I don't think so.
She shouldn't have. Sauron was at Samarathodrathad, but in disguise.
Yeah.
So as long as he doesn't call himself Thu, or Sauron, or Myron, as long as he doesn't use any of his previously established names, he could even call himself the Necromancer at this point, and that wouldn't, because if that part never makes it into the lore of Beleriand. Into the lore of the elves, that doesn't necessarily connect Hobbit Necromancer to Sauron necessarily.
And it doesn't, and that suggests, and Galadriel doesn't have to find out about this. I mean, she never has to see him. He can come to, like, Uldor, like, in Dark of Night. Like, this can literally be a devil's bargain. Like, hi, I am an evil necromancer of massive power who is a representative of the evil god of the north worshipped by your ancestors, and he is going to make you emperor of Beleriand if you betray your new allies and murder your father. And Uldor's like, I'm into it, right?
So there's only one thing we got to be careful of, is that it has to... So... if it's too clear that Uldor is going to successfully betray his father, then the eucatastrophe of the Easterling's arrival is completely suspect.
Yep.
So what the way to solve that is to make it seem like he might get found out. At any moment, he might get found out.
Or he totally rejects the offer.
Because says, no, thank you, and then changes his mind at the last minute.
Right, because if the offer's on the table and we see him reject it, we think, oh, okay, Uldor is not such a bad guy that he would do this terrible thing. And
I like it.
Yeah, but then we're back to Sauron winning by accident again.
Well, no,
because
it wouldn't be by accident.
He's not. Yeah, the offer was on the table. Uldor heard the offer.
Right.
He rejects it. Up front, But he then follows through with it because he does, in fact, hate his dad.
As long as Sarah makes some sort of premonition about what... Well, here's the problem, though. So that problem can be solved as Sauron makes some sort of premonition about what Aldor will find when he gets to the West. However, once he gets to the West and indeed finds the thing that Sauron told him he would find, then we're back to Aldor is definitely going to betray his father. Unless it's something that happens like right before.
Okay. That was going to be my other question. I am currently scrolled over in the canvas so that I'm looking at episode 6 to episode 10. And what I'm seeing is almost no purple in there.
Yeah.
Other than the arrival of the Easterlings in the West, right? In other words, we've got a lot of time in here as far as when the proposal happens. Sauron doesn't even have to proposition him until after they arrive. The Eucatastrophe can happen unclouded. We can just have the Galadriel half of the story until they arrive, and then she's like, hey, I've delivered them, and then meanwhile, like, while people are dying of the plague in Dor Lomond, we can have Uldor the Accursed accepting the Devil's Bargain, for instance. So, I mean, like, we don't have to, it doesn't have to be pre-Eucatastrophe.
Right, because if the entire group of Easterlings can move over the mountains, there's no reason Sauron can't move back over the mountains.
Sure, absolutely.
For this one little meeting, and then he'll go back over the mountains into the East again and hang out with the Emperor at the end.
that's fine. As long as Sauron is involved in the turn.
Yeah. Yeah, he can come and deliver.
You see, I told you it would be this way.
Right.
So would he have to, so he'd have to have two meetings then?
I would think we'd have to, like, we would need a
feeling him out,
a placeholder meeting, right? A getting to know you icebreaker meeting with the evil necromancer who comes in the night, right?
Just normal things,
right? And then the, like, now I've returned and I'm giving, and so Marie, we can even do it like Uldor can be just kind of freaked out at first. Right. And then, but when Sauron comes the second time, then things have changed.
Yeah.
For Uldor. The situation is different. Right.
Okay.
So, and another thing that we can do to maintain the question of how successful this will be is have after the coup, I want to say military coup, but that says something different. After the coup of the military,
yes,
Bors finds out,
yeah,
right, and so he's involved in the attempt to mitigate the damage done by the betrayal, but that's ultimately unsuccessful. So as long as there's enough back and forth, so that we're not tipping the audience off to what the ultimate end of this is going to be,
yes,
too early, then we're fine.
Yeah, no, I think that would work well. So here's
the audience who clearly doesn't have access to the internet.
Right.
But so the idea here is that the death of Alfang will happen like either on the eve of battle or during the battle.
That's what, so one of the things I was going to ask about that was are they simultaneous? That is the betrayal of Ulfang and the betrayal of Maedhros, essentially? Is it one single move? I don't think it can be.
No. So the betrayal of Ulfang happens like the night before they're going
to
go into battle.
Because Uldor has to be leading the troops in battle.
Right.
In order to betray Maedhros.
Yes.
Right. Right.
If Ulfang dies in the battle, especially under mysterious circumstances or whatever... the troops are not going to just automatically start following Uldor and betraying Maedhros.
Especially against the guys that we were fighting for a second ago.
And in fact, I might even suggest separating them by a greater distance than that.
Okay. Sauron gives Uldor the murder weapon.
Yes.
An elvish murder weapon.
Aha.
Galadriel's murder weapon.
Oh, like a dagger or something. Yeah. gives him Galadriel's fancy dagger with which to murder the father.
You know, the one that the rings get made out of eventually.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 No, I'm loving it.
That dagger.
But whatever. Anyway, so we should stop teasing them. But anyway, that's exactly. It's not like someone couldn't similarly spoof many of our ideas. But anyhow,
I'm sure, yeah.
Anyway, but exactly. So that's because it does seem like there does need to be enough separation so that Uldor is not only like technically like has taken over, you know, commanding the armies, but has like recruited the armies to his plan.
Right. That was the thing that I was missing the last time, because I remember that we figured out a way to like grab command and control very quickly by having the Emperor send his own personal bodyguard unit with Uldor as an insurance policy, right? And they're able to very quickly take command. But I like this better because this requires it's just bigger belief that soldiers were going to suddenly follow the command of a bunch of guys who just killed their officers, especially in a situation where their main leader was this very charismatic guy who had their support.
He's going to be loved by the troops.
Uldor's not admitting to the demise of Alfang at all.
Not at
He's
all.
Definitely blaming it on somebody else.
For sure. Yes, and it would make perfect sense that would... Now, I still don't exactly see the link. Like, what motive is he claiming for the crime? Like, why would the elves have come in and murdered Alfang? He has to have some kind of story. But I'm not too worried about that.
They're looking to... Oh, Alfang found out the thing. He found out what they were going to do to us after the war.
They were planning to enslave us and all that stuff. They're just using us for now, and then they're going to enslave us afterwards. So he says that they're going to do exactly what Morgoth actually is going to do, so that makes it ironic and funny. Yes.
Right.
Like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's good. And so, by the way, I have another thing that... Thinking about Uldor's arc here, right? The attitude, remember the idea, you know, Marie, when you were talking about Ulfang's prospects, like why he wanted to go, right? I think we need to recall the council at Estelad, basically, right? I don't mean we need to actually evoke it on screen, but like we need to remember that thing, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, most of the men of the Empire of Bree aren't really going to believe in the Dark Lord in the north, right? When they cross the mountains, so they just know there's a bunch of plush lands over there, and maybe that there's some battle, but Ulfang's not afraid of battle, right? So he's going to go over. Galadriel says there's a lot of open land, and I'm here to represent people who will be your allies. And there are orcs. Maybe they even seen orcs. Orcs sometimes come over the mountains, right? That might not be totally unknown to them, right? So he's like, okay, there are orcs. We can help these elf people stamp out the orcs, and then we'll have lands. Great. She'll tell him about Morgoth, but he probably won't believe, right? It's like, oh, yes, I've heard of this Morgoth thing. This is an old myth that my people have told for a long time, but I don't really believe it, right? And Uldor doesn't believe it, right? But then they cross the mountains, and Uldor might have a moment, right, where they cross the mountains and something happens, which leads Uldor to be like, holy crap, there is, like, the god of the north is real, right? Mm-hmm. All of the legends of my people that I've heard and never really paid much attention, it's all true, right? It's all true. And the ancestral god of my people lives up. He's the enemy that these people are fighting against. He could have this sort of crisis, like almost crisis of faith, right? Which softens him up so that when Sauron comes the second time, he's like, okay, I'm in, right? I'm in. Because at some point they're gonna have to confront the idea. And I'm thinking that this could also be a part of it could fit into like Ulfang himself, I think, would Would he remain skeptical? Would he come to believe the truth too? He doesn't have to before he dies necessarily. That this is an orc stronghold they're fighting would be enough for him, perhaps, but
if this is what he's going to die for, it's probably good that we know what his actual viewpoint is on it.
Right.
Like, so he probably does need to confront that at some point.
So if Olor and Olfang together are basically confronting, like, both of them are like, we didn't believe in this, and now we do, and Olfang has a, like, I am a true believer, I'm now fully with you, Galadriel, yes, it is clear that we must stand with the elves against this and help them overcome this, and meanwhile, Aldor is going the other direction.
Right. With it. I think probably something like that, because Olfang's motivations for coming to Beleriand weren't very corrupt to begin with. So for him to get there, figure out who Morgoth is and be like, yeah, I'm with that guy.
Right.
Like, why? Like, I know there's ancestral stuff, but still, why would he choose him?
Fear.
Yeah, exactly. And Olfang doesn't seem like the kind of guy who makes decisions out of fear.
Right, right. So but Aldor could.
Yeah. And Aldor could be...
combination of fear and opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He is hungry for power. And he would therefore have a bit more respect for somebody who seems to have a lot of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So basically we're saying that Aldor has just a lot of daddy issues associated with his own father and with Morgoth, apparently, all combined together.
It's projected onto Morgoth.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So.
Yep, yep. And Sauron plays on that. And so Sauron doesn't have to have a big role. We don't have to do a big disguise. He just has to show up to Uldor twice. Once to plant the initial seed, which Uldor can kind of say no to, or at least be very noncommittal about. And like, maybe I'll think about it, scary evil necromancer dude, but no promises, right? And then later on. And by the way, I'm slightly kidding about him showing up in the night as like full-on evil sorcerer dude giving devil's bargain. My point is simply, he doesn't have to pretend to be just some guy.
He can make a
direct pitch.
Yeah.
He's played by the actor who plays Sauron, but he's like 6 feet tall instead of 8 feet tall.
Right. He doesn't have to look exactly like Mr. Bingley when he shows up, but he looks more like Mr. Bingley than
normal.
But the general idea being that he is trying to make an offer from a position of power. So he's portraying himself as a powerful necromancer
exactly.
who is in a position to be offering.
Yes.
And definitely still wearing a very nice scarf.
Yes. High neck clothes.
High collars.
Collars. Absolutely. Yes.
Definitely don't want to be showing off the.
Yes. Agreed.
The neck tattoo that a dog left him.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So.
Okay. So that works. Timing wise, this. So by the way, this gives us. What I like about this is it makes the front half of the story almost all Galadriel. And it's a genuine eucatastrophic story up through and even past the eucatastrophe. Olfang's recognition and his like moment where he becomes like a true ally, not just an ally of convenience, right? Mm-hmm. Can look like a further eucatastrophe, like further cementing this deal. And so that can happen if the Easterlings arrive in episode 8, right after the summit, so Mithros meets with them and Galadriel, right, in episode 8. This still gives us we've got episode 9 in which the death of Olfang can happen, right? And in episode 10, we can be getting ready, because episode 11 is when we need to start doing the betrayal by then. So we've got episode 9 for Olfang to die, episode 10 for Uldor to like cement his hold and get things set. Right. And then episode 11, he starts to spring the plan.
Right. And episode 11 is, well, hang on. Because that's got to happen Like when you say starts to spring the plan, what do you mean? What is
the
he
delays
doing?
In the east?
Oh, okay, all right.
Is the yes. phase one of
so
the
he
betrayal
doesn't
plan.
Show up on time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So because I mean that's the first thing that Oldor does is throw off the timing of the attack.
Yes.
So, the army of so. Fingon's army, including Gwyndor, is sitting off, waiting, holding back from pressing the attack because they're supposed to wait until the Easterlings
mm-hmm.
arrive. And I guess there's some sort of prearranged signal because obviously, well, I guess elves could see them that far, but because the world is flat for them.
Yes.
Never mind.
I hear you. I hear you. But anyway, yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. So the beginnings, like the kind of passive that is like just delaying things, beginnings of Oldor's plot, would be then coinciding with both the arrival of Turgon and Gwyndor's charge in episode 11. And then we go on and the actual betrayal. Like the of the full-on Oldor and the Easterlings turn and assault Mythros's flank happens in 12 or 13, wherever we want it to fall in there.
That
all seems to work. Now, we haven't exactly returned to Galadriel's role except for the fact that we had talked about Galadriel being the one to kill Oldor, possibly, though that's also Maglor's job, right? But
yes. We promised to give Maglor another job to heroic in the battle.
Right. We can sort that out when we do the battle and stuff. But as far mm-hmm. as Galadriel's perspective, she's going to be totally like she's not going to be suspicious in between the death of Olfang and the betrayal, is she?
Well, she probably would be if she was having a lot of contact with Oldor, which is why I feel like
the betrayal needs
to happen. Well, as long as she's not right there, it's fine. You know, presumably she's not with them when they're being delayed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they may not even know that it has happened yet.
Right. Right.
Right. So we need to keep certain characters away from Aldor. And Galadriel is the main one, and the secondary one is Curufin. Either of them should be able to figure out that something is not right if they spent any amount of time with the guy.
Right.
So Caranthir is the only one who actually has the relationship with the Easterlings, like the direct liaison. So when they start blaming the elves for things going badly, they're blaming Caranthir.
Right. By the way, Adolo is asking questions about, whether or not Galadriel's telepathic abilities present a problem here. And they don't, because if you don't let you cannot read the mind of an unwilling person. Like, that's right. Not possible. So if Oldor does not allow her to read his mind, she cannot. It's just a rule that, you know, Tolkien said. So no, it's for communication. She can't, but you have to open yourself up to the reading.
Now, of course, if Oldor, if she were meeting with Oldor and he refused to allow her to see what he was thinking, she might get suspicious. But I think that all that we have to do there is just not put her in close contact with him.
And it's also kind of rude for her to try that, frankly.
Yeah, but she's not above doing that sort of thing to people she's met. So
you mean testing the hearts of random people? Yeah.
Yeah, no, she's not overly concerned about whether or not that's rude.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
But yeah, we can at some point discuss how we want to portray Asanoe Kenta in film because that does matter. Questions like, what can Galadriel know when she's not there?
Yeah.
Is important. And I agree that not having her in the room changes the dynamics a lot. Mm-hmm. So if she doesn't know the guy, she doesn't know to be watching out for him.
Yeah.
But yeah, we can only keep her out of the room for so long before it looks contrived.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if the camp isn't anywhere close, yeah. Like, so yeah. My thought is that in order for the delaying to actually happen, they've got to be camped pretty far away from where the battle is going to take place. And I imagine that they're actually being kept far away specifically to make their presence an unknown as far as Morgoth is concerned.
Right. Right.
And Galadriel, it's not like Galadriel is going to personally lead the armies of Ulfang into battle. Right. No.
That was Ulfang's job.
That was Ulfang's job. And yeah. Anyway, sorting out some of these details, there are issues that we need to sort through, but we can sort through that when we get not even to the episode level, when we get to planning the battle level, which is transitionally next, I believe. But other than that, I think we're still, the rest of the plot line, I think, works pretty well.
Okay. I do have a few questions still remaining. One is, are we going to go back to Gondolin before Turgon shows up, or is his showing up truly going to be a complete surprise?
I think that we have to go back at least one time, which...
Why? I would vote for there a complete surprise.
Really?
Yeah, totally would. Especially if we're going to spend our whole leisurely first episode in Gondolin, get a chance to meet everybody, get a chance to, through our three different human perspectives on staying and trusting elves and everything, and thereby hearing from different elves of Gondolin perspectives on involvement in the outer world and everything. Everything's going to be all set up. All the major players, what they think, why they would do what they would do, and then boom, the surprise happened, and it's a surprise. It's a surprise to everybody. It surprises the viewers. It surprises everybody. But it's not going to come out of nowhere because we had a whole episode
right at
the beginning of the season in which we met all these people and heard from them about whether or not to do something like this. And so, you know, so it's a surprise, but it doesn't come out of nowhere.
Okay. So, I mean, honestly, I was thinking just having one of the one of our famous closing montages for an episode, just having Turgon staring northwards, you know, while eagles flew overhead, like just so that he knows, to establish that he knows what's going on.
Right.
Because if all that's happened is these three kids showed up and they were like, we totally want to go fight Morgoth. Sorry. Yeah. They would, it like him showing up with an army, like why would he? He would show up by himself and be like, hey guys, I would like to rejoin life in Beleriand. But he doesn't do that. He shows up with a huge army.
Because he knows
so he's gotta know that things are happening. And yeah. So the reason why we have to at least show him is we have to establish that he knows that something's going on.
So I would not be, I'm not saying that this suggestion is a good idea. I'm just saying I wouldn't argue against it if you wanted to do it. Instead of showing Gondolin, we could just talk about Gondolin.
Okay.
Like, it could be one of those moments in which Húrin doesn't break his oath, but like, everybody totally knows what he's talking about, right? Like, basically, it's gotta come up as they're doing their summit, right? Somebody has to be like, so, what about Turgon, right? Let's brainstorm in the room for a second. Any way we can get Turgon involved in this? Because that would be handy, right? And then Húrin
does anybody know where to find him?
Right. And Húrin's like, I have no idea, and I can say nothing about this. However, you know, I'm, I don't, and somebody can even say, like, but how would Turgon even know of our need? And Hurin could be all like, I wouldn't worry about that. Like,
right. And at some point while Hurin's in position, he looks, he looks up and sees the eagles flying by. And so we establish that he knows that Turgon knows.
And he can, I mean, and so he can in some way, even indirectly communicate like, he's a prophet.
We're fine with bringing Gondolin up throughout the season, maybe having a brief glimpse of eagles and Gondolin to remind the viewer visually that this is a thing, but we don't need any scenes back in Gondolin of people in Gondolin discussing, hey, so
should we go or should we not go?
I definitely didn't want it to be established that that it was on the table. Long as we are able to establish that there's information getting back to Turgon, I'm fine with it.
Okay. So we don't need any scenes really in Gondolin, which means we don't need a Gondolin storyline anywhere.
I don't think so. Not until they come out anyway. But again, we both have invested a lot of time in the Gondolin thing.
And okay. So next and here's the other thing. If the arrival of the Gondolin the Gondolindrum happens after the betrayal of Ulfang, then the audience is like, oh, but the Gondolindrum have gotten here, so it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, even if things go
right, we'll have lots of ups and downs in the last few episodes to sort out of, is this going to go well or not. The other question is the prisoners in Angband, specifically Gwilym, do we need to see them at all throughout the season? Or are we fine with him just being dragged out to his death at the very end and people being like, oh no.
I think we set that up just with Gwyndor piteously recalling his brother and imagining talking about as part of his discussion with Vindulis, presumably, right? Are you asking me to abandon my brother who is doubtless enduring torment at this very moment, et cetera, et cetera. And then like, oh, and there he is. It's my brother itself, right? That we were just, I was inviting you to imagine. And now here he is getting dismembered in front of us. Yeah. Right.
Okay, because I mean, we did show him as part of the prisoners of Angband storyline with Luthien in Angband, so that's the last time we would have seen him. But that's fine. I mean, I'm not saying we needed to see him again. I'm just asking if we needed to see.
I wouldn't think
again.
So. But I mean, okay. You know.
All right. Do we need to see Angband itself, like hang out with Morgoth, day in the life of a Balrog kind of thing?
I was noticing that of the villain stuff we discussed last time, there doesn't seem much opportunity for most of it. Like, conversation with Balrogs, for instance.
I didn't know where to put it.
I'm kind of fine with that, because, like, one of the things about the Nirnaeth is the portrayal of Thangorodrim as this unstoppable force.
Yeah.
Which humanizing them by having conversations with them actually serves to. One of the things about the Dagor Bragalach that I think worked out very well for us is that right up until the end, we didn't know what the bad guys were actually thinking about and doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, at the end of that, Sauron gives us the synopsis of why this has actually gone terribly for us, but that's right before the duel with Morgoth, right? So that's actually, if anything, set up for that. And we're prepared at that point to bring Morgoth down to a level at which we can fight him. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, we're not going to do that at all.
Yeah. No, I agree. Having the walls of Angband be kind of like a big old black box that we think we know how to attack, but we don't really know what's coming from inside. I agree that that's a better effect for this season.
Not to mention, we spent a lot of time in Angband last season.
We did. And we're going to be... A lot of the stuff that we were discussing last time was really to set up the conversation with Hurin, between Hurin and Morgoth, which is not going to happen in this season anyway. But anyway, yeah. Yes. All right. I agree. One question, though. Mm-hmm. Does Sauron make contact?
With Angband?
Yeah.
I think not until the end, if at all.
Like,
he's got to want to claim his victory, though.
He's going to want to say, because I delivered the Easterlings.
Yeah, he just had a pretty significant loss of power. And he, to prove that he's still got it, he would have to say, hey, that thing that just happened, that was me.
You're welcome. Yeah. Yeah.
What can I say?
Yeah. I don't know when to do that.
He doesn't have to personally show up.
No, he doesn't.
Uldor can say that Sauron sends his greetings. You know, can say that, you know, the necromancer sends his greetings. Who sends his greetings?
Yeah, but they're all going to die. So
the battle. Oh yeah, he's dead. Yeah.
I was thinking Sauron doesn't have to do it personally tomorrow. He doesn't just show up in Angband. He could have some meeting with a messenger. I don't know.
A Balrog,
for instance. Durin's Bane and Sauron meeting for, you know, having nachos in a truck stop up in North Beleriand and catching up.
That's a Balrog conversation. We can work it out, because we were going to have his tag at the end of the season be like hanging out with the Emperor and Bree saying,
but we don't have to do that anymore.
Right. This would be instead of that, have him.
We could still do it. What? No reason for Sauron not to move forward with the Emperor of Bree plan. Not that I have any plans for the Emperor of Bree plan long term. Yeah. But
which is why it might make more sense for that tag to now be him checking in at Angband and being like, wasn't I awesome in that battle? And Gothamon's like, you weren't even in that battle.
Right.
And he's like, well, I didn't fight it myself, but you did notice that giant Easterling army, yeah?
Right.
Well, and I think that Gothamog might deliver the final insult that will seal his fate ultimately to another tool of Sauron's one day.
Seal Gothamog's fate?
Yeah, he's working on the Gondolin weapons plan. The anti-Balrog technology that apparently is going to go from Sauron.
You didn't recognize that, but that's none of my business.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, we can sort all that out at some point in the future. But for now, do we like the shape of this?
Overall shape, yeah.
Okay,
I do.
Cool.
I do.
Right,
I think
I'll
it's definitely enough to work with. Yeah. Yep. Enough to get started planning episodes. So I was just looking back at it because it's been a while since I looked at the beginning of the season. But yeah, no, I think this works. There's a lot to like. I'm glad we've solved the Rhiannon Huor problem, the marriage and kids progress with Hurin and Morwen makes sense. You know, that's now like fairly compelling in how it fits in with the rest of the storyline. Yeah. Good. All right. Excellent. Well, it's very late. So, I spent all my time on the Canva, and so we've got the Canva in other places here in summaries. But next time, we're going to come back to the battle. So we're still kind of lumping a lot of stuff there into the last four episodes. So we'll work a little more on the four episodes, because we need several different versions of the battle plan, right, in order to make sure that we're clear on what's going to happen and what's supposed to happen. What might happen, what's then supposed to happen, and what does actually happen. Are all the things that we need to sort out. So we'll do that next time. And our next time, Will be, oops, sorry, I didn't change the date. Not on the 29th, it will be on March 7th instead. Thursday, March 7th. So 3 weeks from tonight, we will be returning to the battle. All right?
Probably,
yes. Almost certainly. Well, okay. Very likely on March 7th. So I got some family stuff happening, but I'm pretty sure Thursday, March 7th will be fine. All right. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for the wonderful discussion here tonight. Feeling good about the shape of things. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening and Godspeed.